One, we have, I guess we've gotten Joseph to Egypt and through Potiphar's house and into prison, and now we're going to get him out tonight kind of continue to see how this story goes. It takes, it's hard to say it's an unexpected turn when we all know the story so well, but it is one of these kind of unexpected rise stories, and there are a whole bunch of these in the Bible. This is something of a standard biblical sort of motif, if I can use that word. You've got the story of the nation itself being slaves in Egypt and rising to this great powerful nation under Solomon. You've got the story of David, this shepherd boy, the youngest in the family, rising to be this great king. You've got the orphan girl who rises to become the Persian monarch. You've got this child who is born without a home in a manger, who rises to the right hand of God. And all of this, I think, is ultimately kind of pointing forward to that last story, of course, but you find it here in Joseph as well. And that's really going to start tonight, where he begins in the prison and winds up second in command in all of Egypt. Let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for this day that you've given us, for this opportunity that we have to dedicate our time to your word, to the things that you have revealed and preserved about your people and your plan and your character. And we ask that we would be open to what you have shown us, that we would grow in wisdom and knowledge, and that we would come to know you better and be more like you. In your Son we pray. Amen. So, chapter 40 is the chapter of the two dreams of the two prison mates. And I mentioned this back in chapter 37, I believe it was. It may have been chapter 39. That things happen in pairs in the Joseph story. Lots of pairs of things happening. And the pair of dreams in chapter 40 are going to be mirrored by another pair of dreams in chapter 41. These two dreams that Pharaoh will have in chapter 41 about what he's going to say see and what that's going to mean. And this is going to be the path for Joseph. We'll spend some time reading. I don't know. This is a long chapter in terms of number of verses. It's pretty simple, I think, but we'll spend some time, at least at the beginning, reading some of it. We'll see how that goes over the course of the entire class. but beginning in verse 1, seems like a simple place to start. After 2 whole years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and behold, there came up out of the Nile 7 cows, attractive and plump, and they fed in the reed grass. And behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly, thin cows ate up the 7 attractive, plump cows. And Pharaoh awoke. He fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on one stalk. And behold, after them sprouted 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump, full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. So in the morning his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my offenses today, when Pharaoh was angry at his servants and put me and the chief baker in the custody of the house of the captain of the guard. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving us an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about, and I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged. We'll stop there. That'll get us going a little ways into the text. So as we said last time, Joseph has asked the chief cupbearer for kind of a repayment on the favor that he did him in interpreting the dream. And he at least presumably allows for it not to be an immediate thing when he says, you know, when all is well with you, remember me. And as we said last time, it's, you know, however long Joseph expected it to take before he felt comfortable making some kind of request to Pharaoh, after 2 whole years is probably not what he had in mind. But it does work out in Joseph's favor, because this is going to be the situation that not only gets him out, but it gets him out with a path to travel at all. And you think about it, if Joseph is released 2 months later, after interpreting the cupbearer in the baker's dreams.
Sure.
Thank you. And Pharaoh says, "All right, you know, I've heard your case. I think you should be let go." What does he do now? Does he try to go back home at that point? Has he, as we talked about last time, already kind of reached a point where home doesn't seem to be as good of an option? Does he try to re-ingratiate himself to Potiphar? Where is his path? Well, the way that it all works out, instead, he has a path at the end of all of this that God has prepared for him. And Pharaoh dreams this dream, as in the case in a lot of places, in the ancient world, dreams were seen to be very significant. There are professional dream interpreters. In the Daniel class I'm teaching over at the college, we've talked about this at some length in Babylonian culture because of, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. They had dream interpretation manuals that their wise men would consult in interpreting dreams. I don't know that there are those in Egyptian culture. I've not read about any such thing. But I do know that in a lot of ancient Egyptian texts, the pharaohs were credited with having revelatory dreams. And so dreams meant something in general, but Pharaoh's dreams were dreams from the gods, is how they thought of them. And that makes perfect sense because Pharaoh was a son of the gods in their mythology as well. And so that all makes very good sense. So when the pharaoh has a dream, he wants to know what it means. And what we're going to find is that no one can interpret it, which, again, sounds a whole lot like Daniel. There's a lot of Daniel-Joseph echoing going on in these kind of court stories of Joseph and Daniel in their respective courts. But the dreams themselves are interesting, I guess, is one way of saying it. You've got in the first dream 7 plump, attractive cows that are in the water. And it sounds kind of strange as you read it. They came up out of the Nile. That's really not to be seen as a weird thing. What I think we're to envision is cows submerging themselves in the water to stay cool and keep the bugs away from them, because cows do that in, you know, ponds and stuff all the time. So they're just down in the river, and they're coming up out of the river, as they do when they're done being in the river for a while. Now, a couple things about this. First of all, cows are very symbolic in Egyptian culture. They're symbolic of a variety of things. They're symbolic of the nation of Egypt itself, which is an interesting thing. They kind of are the symbol of the nation. They are representative of the god Isis, one of the main gods of the Egyptian pantheon, and a few other things as well. They're not as significant, but there's a strong connection between Egypt and the cow. And so that's an important thing to know as well. Also, the number 7 is symbolic in all kinds of ancient Near Eastern cultures. This is not just an Israelite thing. About everywhere we look, 7 is a symbolic number. And so it means the same sort of thing that you typically think of it as. So if you have a cow that is symbolic of many Egyptian sorts of things, a perfect number of them, and they're beautiful, attractive, well-fed cows, and you're thinking in terms of this must mean something because we're interpreting dreams, it's really not that complex of a sort of thing to work through. And I think that's an important thing to realize, is because, let's just hold off on that for a second. Well, after these 7 plump, attractive cows, 7 thin, ugly cows come up next, instead of eating grass, as cows do, they eat the other cows, which is all kinds of weird. Not only are they eating cows, but they're eating cows that are much larger than them and not showing any gain from having done it. They don't tell us that at this point in the story. But when we get down to verse 21, as the dream is being retold there to Joseph, when they had eaten them, no one would have known they had eaten them, for they were still as ugly as in the beginning. And so nothing changed about these cows after eating the first 7 cows. And Pharaoh awoke, and then he fell asleep, and he dreamed a second time, and this time it's 7 ears of grain instead of 7 cows. It's the exact same dream, except it's ears of grain instead of cows. And again, a pretty simple sort of thing to pick up on the symbolism of. I mean, in later times, Egypt was called the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Lots and lots of food and grain were coming from this place. It's not a difficult sort of thing to interpret, but he has the dream again. And this is interesting. In verse 7, when Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream, there's a little bit of surprise to this. And you think, well, that's ridiculous. Of course it's a dream. Cows don't eat other cows, and grain doesn't eat other grain. What do you mean, behold, it was a dream? Well, I don't know about you, but every now and then, you'll have a really, really, really weird dream that seems really real somehow. And in spite of how weird and impossible it is, as soon as you wake up, you're like, oh, it was just a dream. And then if you stop and think about it, you're like, well, yeah, of course it was a dream. I think it's that kind of dream is the point. It has that kind of level of realism, of reality to it, that makes Pharaoh think something real is happening, even though there's no possible way this could actually happen. But that seems to be the significance of his surprise upon awaking. And so he calls all of his magicians, of course, and this is another kind of echo of that you find in the Daniel stories. None of them can interpret. I mean, that is the constant in Daniel 1 through 5 is something shows up, and we need it interpreted. We bring in this parade of interpreters, and none of them know anything about what's going on. Well, here's the first place that that happens, back in the Joseph story. He sent and called for all his magicians of Egypt and the wise men, told him his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. And again, I think on the one hand, there's something that's relatively obvious about it. And I know I'm helped by the fact that we have hindsight, and I know the story, and I know what it means. But be that as it may, if you want to, in symbolic dream terms, say Egypt is going to be doing really, really well and prosperous for 7 years, and then there's going to be such a famine that it's going to be as if those prosperous years never happened for another 7 years, you can't do much more clear symbolic way of talking about that than seven fat cows, seven fat ears of grain being completely devoured by seven thin cows and seven thin ears of grain, so to speak. So, again, I know I have the benefit of hindsight, but I think there's something to be said for the fact that these are not terribly complicated dreams to interpret as far as symbolic language goes. And the point of that, I think, ultimately, is that God is concealing the message. You have a revelation from God and a bunch of pagan interpreters who think that their king is a son of their God receiving a revelation from their God. And that's why they think that they can interpret it. And so I think there is a theological point to the fact that these people can't understand this message. And it's because these people can't understand the messages of God. Only one of God's servants can understand this by God's hand and God's revealing of this message and this meaning. I'll stop for a second. I've been going on for a while. Any thoughts about the dreams themselves? I'm going to move along to the cupbearer in a second. So, yeah, Charlie?
So, this might sound like a really simple question, but did they not dream at all back in that time? Or did he just like, oh, I have a dream. Tell me what it means.
I think it's more along the lines of they all had dreams, but there were some dreams that they thought meant something. You wake up sometimes and you have some vague recollection of a dream. You don't think that much about it. Other times you wake up and there is just this vividness of a dream that you had. And in this kind of culture where dreams meant something, dreams were premonitions, dreams were revelations from the gods, when you had that kind of dream, it was, I need to find out what this means. And so I don't think it's something that was unique that he'd never had a dream like this before. And I also don't think it's unique that it's the first time he ever asked anyone to interpret a dream. It's just that this is the first time he received a revelation from God as far as it goes. Anything else here? Yeah, Steve?
What did they do then?
Right.
What are they doing differently or failing to do now?
I've seen both of those kind of approaches taken to this. One is that they were so stumped they couldn't say anything. And one is, well, of course they said something. Pharaoh just wasn't satisfied with the answers. He didn't think that they were good answers. And I don't know that we can know for sure which of those is the case. I think either of those is a logical possibility in terms of interpreting what the text says. As to why they had no ability to read this dream, what was God doing? Again, it's hard to say. What I would liken it to is when the mob of the city of Sodom are standing outside of Lot's door, and God strikes them with blindness so that they can't find the door, even though they're standing at the door. It's obvious where it is, but God has done something beyond, I think, beyond just striking them with physical blindness to prevent them from finding the very place that they're at. And I think that sort of idea would work well here, that God has done something to their mental faculties to prevent them from seeing what might have been an obvious interpretation otherwise. But I don't know. We're not told how God does it. It may be, as far as I know, these may not be the sorts of images that ever showed up in dreams. I mean, they may have had their own kind of dream interpretation manual where this symbol means this, and this symbol means this, and this symbol means this. And they just had no clue because they'd never seen this kind of dream before. So it may be something as simple as that, is God has done something that seems obvious to us in retrospect with the answer given to us. But for them, it was completely different from anything they'd experienced. But I don't know. I know, right? Yeah, Dan.
And we don't know the context exactly, but we know that even the wise men and the interpreters knew they could not authoritatively interpret it someone else's dream. Or even they can guess at it and make it like, oh yeah, I know exactly what I'm talking about. This is what that means, but they don't know that.
Yeah.
And so they know that. Now, I don't know if this is the same Pharaoh or not, but last one just killed his servants and was furious. So they might be saying, you know, I'm kind of holding back and not providing my thing. If it turns out to be false, then I'm the next one to get hung on a tree.
Yeah. I've always presumed it was the same guy.
The New American Standard seems to say, it seems to say it's a new, because in verse 9 and 10, he's saying, Pharaoh's furious. It's like he's telling him, you know, maybe it is the same one.
When your honor, when your majesty, I mean,
right.
That's the question there. Is he talking about the last Pharaoh, or is he referring to him in an honorific title? But yeah. Maybe it is something like that. Let's not go too far down the speculation road, I guess. But there's all kinds of interesting things to think about as far as it's going on here. Anything else before we move on? All right, well, the cupbearer remembers Joseph at this point. And you wonder after 2 years, I mean, we said at the beginning, obviously he didn't completely forget Joseph. It's a forgetting of convenience for his own sake. But you wonder after 2 years whether he's thought about him so little that it's almost practically having forgotten him at this point until this comes up again, where he is, you know, now he has an opportunity to help the Pharaoh. And this is the sort of thing that's good for the cupbearer. It's not just good for Joseph. It's not just good for the Pharaoh. If he gets Joseph to this guy and Joseph does the job as well as he did it last time, then, I mean, finder's fee isn't quite the phrase to use here, but that sort of idea that he'll probably get a pat on the back, this is advantageous to him to let him know about Joseph. So they go get Joseph. They bring him out. I mean, the cupbearer basically just kind of retells the story of chapter 40 in two verses. They go get Joseph. They quickly bring him out of the pit. When they had shaved him and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. So Joseph has been down in the prison for a few years now, at least 2 years. Who knows how long before that? No more than 13. He's been in prison for a while, and they're kind of tidying him up to present him before the Pharaoh. The one thing that's worth noting about that, beyond the obvious, is the shaving point. which probably has less to do with the fact that he's unkempt from being in prison and more to do with the fact with Egyptians and Semitic people do not see eye to eye on the issue of facial hair. The Semitic people were very much bearded people, and the Egyptians were clean-shaven. And so it's not just that he has a scraggly beard, it's they want to shave him clean to present him to Pharaoh. So that's just an interesting, I guess, cultural note to mention there. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I have heard it was said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream I was standing on the banks of the Nile. And he retells the dream as it goes. And then down in verse 25, Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years. And the seven empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them will arise 7 years of famine. And all the years of plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the seven plentiful years, and let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming up, and store grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. The food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine. All right, a few things through this part of the text. First of all, this phrase that Pharaoh says to Joseph, I hear that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. This is one of those spots where the Hebrew is a bit more choppy, and it might signify that Pharaoh is saying something even stronger than this. It's hard to be certain with this, but literally it's something along the lines of you hear a dream to interpret it. And if there is significance of that beyond, you know, it just meaning when you hear a dream, you can interpret it, this might indicate that to hear the dream is to interpret the dream for Joseph, which would be a very different sort of thing than your typical professional dream interpreter that would be consulting books or doing ceremonies or chants or arm waving or whatever else those kinds of magicians would be doing. For Joseph, to hear the dream is to know the interpretation. Now, that's reading something into the literalistic Hebrew here, which may or may not be there, so take that for what it's worth. But that's an interesting point to consider at the very least, I think. Joseph's response, of course, is something of a model response in this context. It is not in me. No, I can't do this. But God will give the interpretation, where he's doing a couple of things here, and what I tend to focus more on usually is that he's deflecting credit for him from himself and giving it to God instead, which is turning down an opportunity for personal gain. He's been waiting for at least 2 years to get a chance to have an audience with Pharaoh, and he gets an audience with Pharaoh, and Pharaoh just lobs out a softball for him to, you know, just crush over the fences, and he goes, no, I can't do that, but God can. And so it's an amazing thing that he's doing here. And it's an interesting thing as well, because the rest of the chapter, or when this comes back up again, Pharaoh never talks about Joseph as an interpreter again. He talks about God as the revealer all the way through. Here is one little thing that Joseph says in one moment that impacts the way Pharaoh thinks about Joseph and Joseph's God. That he continues to talk about God as the revealer and Joseph merely as the intermediary. I mean, those aren't the terms that he uses necessarily, but that's clearly the idea that you get when you get down to verses 38 and 39, Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, and there's none as wise and discerning as you are," and so forth and so on it goes. Joseph's little confession here has made an impact on Pharaoh. Now, there's one other side of this that I don't have on the screen that's worth noting as well, and that is that by answering this way, not only is he being humble and deflecting credit and giving honor where honor is due, but he's also giving Pharaoh something better than what Pharaoh thought he had. Pharaoh thought he had a good dream interpreter coming up, but instead what he's saying is, no, I'm giving you the divine interpretation of this. And so it strengthens what Joseph says by way of interpreting it as well. It's not my interpretation, it's God's interpretation that you're going to receive here. And so that's a significant thing to consider as well. Joseph says two dreams have one meaning, 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine, so severe to devour the plenteous years. Notice also the repeated idea that this is what God is about to do. This is God who is going to be doing this. And it's repeated in a way to emphasize the need to act and to act wisely about all of this. But it's also worth noting that you've got a few interesting things happening. You've got an edict from God to a pagan king, ultimately, which is not the sort of thing that happens a whole lot. But this is not an edict of judgment. This is not a warning to repent. And if you repent, then this judgment is not going to befall you. So it's not that kind of message from God. And also it's the kind of message from God that is completely unintelligible to Pharaoh without Joseph. And so this is God's means of retrieving Joseph from the prison. This is the path that he has set for Joseph so that Joseph can then save his family, so that he can then relocate the family to this safe place to grow as a nation. Safe at the beginning. To grow as a nation and set the stage for fulfilling the other prophetic dreams that he began with. And so this is just an incredibly dire situation that's going. And this is where Joseph then takes another step beyond what he's been asked to do. This is the sort of thing that Daniel does this as well in Daniel chapter 4 when Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of the tree that gets chopped down. And so after interpreting it, this is going to happen to you, Nebuchadnezzar. I wish it would happen to one of your enemies, but it's going to happen to you. He takes that step out and says, now let me tell you what you should do. You should repent and change your life. Joseph is not that bold, but still, here's a prisoner who's just been got done being washed up to be presented to Pharaoh and tells Pharaoh the interpretation of the dream and goes, oh, by the way, let me tell you how you should handle this. It's a pretty bold thing for him to do when you stop and you think about it. But he does offer this counsel, and the counsel is hire yourself a really good boss who knows what's going on, first of all. Someone who's going to oversee this entire program, who is wise, who has insight, who can run this whole thing without it falling apart. Then you need overseers throughout the land to make sure that what this guy says actually happens. This is what we would call middle management, but good middle management, not bad middle management. They're the ones stationed throughout the nation making sure that the plan is implemented. And the plan is to double tithe during the years of plenty, one-fifth of everything that everybody gets is going into storehouses. And you think, man, that's a lot. A double tithe is, you're taking food away from people. Well, no, you're not, actually. It's so incredibly plenteous, there's more than enough. Everyone's doing great. And what this is doing is preventing waste. It's making sure that all of this stuff isn't, you know, rotting in the fields so that they all starve later on. Now, the question that I think is fascinating to think through, that we cannot answer definitively, but I still think it's fascinating to think through, is does Joseph have himself in mind? If Joseph, you know, were free to talk on this, you know, surely he wouldn't be that bold, but if would he have finished his sentence by saying, and you know what, I think I know just the man for the job? Or is Joseph the last person that he would have in mind for this? Because, you know, 5 minutes ago he was a prisoner. On top of that, he's a foreigner. On top of that, he's a Semitic foreigner from a shepherding family, and he's going to be the one in a couple of chapters to say that shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians. He's inexperienced politically. Everything that he has faced in his life up to this point has been one setback after another. So for him to think he's going to get this job would be quite a psychological jump for him. I mean, my thinking personally is probably he just hopes he's going to be free after this. But I don't know. What do you think? Oh, that's obviously the case. God put these words in Joseph's mouth, and you know that it sets up for Joseph because Pharaoh's response is going to be, pick someone wise and discerning with insight. And Pharaoh says, since no one's as discerning and wise as you are, he has set himself up for this probably without even knowing that he was setting himself up for this. But it's an interesting thing to consider. Yeah, Charlie? Oh, yeah.
So, the captain of the guard in prison is coaching Joseph to say how to say it, how to approach Pharaoh, because, I mean, we can do that now. We need to go to the White House. You were told what to do, how to do it, when to sit in, when to talk, everywhere.
That's an interesting thing to think about is, you know, presuming we're still talking about Potiphar as the captain of the guard who's in charge of this prison, and he gets word that Joseph needs to go out to go meet with Pharaoh, and he's in the process of cleaning him up. What sort of prep? Because Joseph is going to do the same thing with his brothers. When the family comes down to Egypt later, he says, now when you guys meet Pharaoh, this is how you need to act. So the idea that Potiphar would be at least offering some sort of guidance to Joseph on his meeting with Pharaoh is not at all speculative, I don't think. I think that's a natural sort of thing to think about. That's an interesting thought. All right. Pharaoh says, hey, you're right. That's a fantastic idea. You're the man for the job. And again, it is since God has shown you all this. Now, I don't think that we're to read Pharaoh as a convert to worship of Yahweh, the God of heaven, as a monotheist from this point forward. That's just almost certainly not whatever happens, with maybe one exception, when you have polytheistic kings in the Bible acknowledging God. God is a great God of revelation, or God is a great God of deliverance, or God is a great God of salvation. That be akin to them saying, and I also have this great God of the rain, and this great God of fertility, and the God of the sun, and the God of the moon, too. They just now have a God of deliverance to add to their shelf. That's just how the polytheistic mind works. So he's probably not confessing God as the only God at this point, but it is clear to him. I mean, he is spiritually discerning enough to realize that a God is with Joseph at the very least. Since God has shown you all of this, there is none so discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards to the throne, I will be greater than you. And so he's appointing Joseph to this position, which, again, I have to think is far beyond anything Joseph could have ever imagined. Even if Joseph, in the back of his mind, were harboring the hope that he would get this job, which I think is unlikely, but it's possible, I don't think he would have equated this job with the second most powerful person in all of Egypt, which is, in essence, the second most powerful person in all the world. I just can't imagine that's what he would have expected. Now, Pharaoh does make reference to his own power, but notice that this reference to his own power is a way of emphasizing how extensive Joseph's power is. When he says, only as regards to the throne will I be more powerful than you, that's a way of saying, my throne is the sole exception to your entire power in this regard. And so, I'll get to you one second, Greg. They then go through this ceremony, the ceremonial bestowal of authority on Joseph. He is given Pharaoh's signet ring, so he writes and signs things with the authority of Pharaoh, linen garments, which would be the finest garments around. And again, this clothing motif shows up, unlike the cloak that was stolen by the brothers and used to perpetuate a lie, unlike the cloak stolen by Potiphar's wife and used to perpetuate a lie. And both of those have him trending downward. This is a symbol of his great promotion at this point, the gold chain, which would have been worn by royalty. He is put in the second chariot, the ancient equivalent, ancient Egyptian equivalent of Air Force Two, and paraded around Egypt with a command of bow the knee. Again, everyone, I'm talking about a foreshadowing, Dan, every knee will bow before Joseph there in Egypt. And there are a variety of these kinds of messianic foreshadowings in Joseph's story, to be sure. Notice also in verse 44, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up a hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Again, just how extensive his power is. And by starting it as, I am Pharaoh, and by the power vested in me by the nation of Egypt, again, that's not exactly what it means, but that's the idea. With the full authority of who I am as Pharaoh. And again, think about that in Egyptian culture, Egyptian context. It's not just the king of Egypt, but it's the son of the chief god of the Egyptian pantheon is who he is. And by his authority, nobody is going to so much as lift their hand without Joseph's say-so. And finally, then, he is given an Egyptian name that there is no agreement on what that means. I've seen at least four different interpretations of what his Egyptian name might mean, so I didn't even bother with that. And he's given an Egyptian wife as well, who's a daughter of a priest. An Egyptian name and Egyptian wife is your naturalizing the foreigner, is part of what's going on here, making him more palatable to the people. It's going to become relevant later. We'll come back to this in a later chapter, that he is now married into the priestly caste. That's worth noting. And the fact that he is a priest of On, Potipharah, which is obviously a similar name to Potiphar, but it's not the same person, unless he's the captain of the guard and a priest. On is a location. It's not the priest of the deity On. It's the priest of the location On. The city of On is later named Hierapolis by the Greeks because of its sun worship. I didn't dig into how far back that sun worship goes, but if it does go all the way back, that would be the deity in question. But I don't know that. Also, I learned today when you jot notes down and the name of the place is On, it can be very confusing since that's a normal word. Like, On a city? On a city? What does that mean? Oh, On is a city. Got it. Greg, what were you going to say?
Potiphar might have been grooming Joseph, saying, okay, I think this might go well. So, I don't know. Again, it's pure supposition. Or maybe God is purely in control and everybody is helpless under God's driving all these events to the point of even finding this unsuspecting Hebrew plucked recently out of prison to be number two in command in the land of Egypt.
That's always the interesting question when you start dealing with human will and God's foreordination and providential control, is how do those things work together? It's a funny story. One of the professors at the college was talking about this very thing and made the comment that, you know, if anyone can write me a paper and convince me how human will and God's providence and foreordination all works together and you know, can convince me of it, then I'll just give you an A for the rest of the semester. You don't have to come back. And of course, some students said, oh, I'll do that. I'll take you up on that, which is ridiculous because this is the very sort of thing that philosophers and theologians have been arguing about for 6,000 years. Of course, someone thought they could do it. That's a great question and a great thing to think about is, you know, how much is God directing and how much is God using? And how much other is there? How much overlap is there? And that's the point of all of it, of course, ultimately, is God works through our actions when we work with him. God works through our actions when we work against him. God works through our actions when we couldn't care less about him. And that is the sovereignty of God. And that I feel comfortable saying. As to the specific logistics of that, that's where it gets a little bit more hairy, perhaps. Yeah, Adam?
I'm trying to think of how to express this. You know, all of us are kind of subject to the decisions of powerful, important people. No matter where you live in the world, most people, that there are going to be important people, whether it's a president or a king or owner of a company or something. decision that the Pharaoh makes on this one day is going to impact the next 14 years. It's going to impact the lives of everybody in Egypt. It's going to impact the lives of people outside of Egypt who wind up coming to Egypt for food, including Joseph's family. And, I mean, 14 years, it's like, that's 3.5 presidential terms for the United States. I mean, we spend all this time and energy in, trying to select a president. This amount, this one decision is going to impact a long time.
Which is to say nothing of the fact that that's going to put Joseph in the position to move his whole family down here, which impacts the beginning
exactly.
of, yeah.
Exactly. That's just the immediate.
Right.
But, Jesus and all that. So, Pharaoh had no idea when he went to bed that night that any of this would happen or that the next day he would be appointing a man to be second in command overall. He had no idea that any of that was going to happen. And I imagine people living in the country and people living outside of the country probably had not a lot of, inkling of what was going on here in the story either, and yet their food was provided for them. I mean, there are countless families who were being fed over these 14 years who probably didn't understand what happened here, and it's just, I think, a reminder to me that even if I find myself in the position of somebody who is subject to decisions of other people above me, God is working everything out, and He's going to provide food for me and my family. I don't know all the decisions and things that happen behind the scenes, and we really have no idea how involved Jesus is in all these things.
I mean, unless this came with some kind of press release about Pharaoh's dreams and the interpretation of those dreams, all of a sudden there's this Semite who's in charge of everything for apparently no reason to all of the people. So the thought that this would be a shocking kind of thing and no one would have any idea what's going on, I think certainly is a reality here. But yeah, you're right. It does reflect that God is in control and God is managing things. Yeah, Charlie.
I know we don't have much time, but 43.
Yeah.
42 and 43. Don't say this to you. How does this relate to Mordecai and then Jesus with the clothes, the ring?
It's probably closer to the little shindig that Haman has planned for himself than when Mordecai is actually promoted. There's some similarity there, but it's closer to what when Haman says, "This is what you should do for the man the king delights to honor." It's closer to that, and the significance there would be that everything Haman asks for is like a level above what they're giving Joseph. Haman is asking to be treated like a king rather than treated like a second in command. So that'd be the closer connection and significance there. Stephen?
Well, I was thinking about this, kind of what's in Joseph's head. Kind of considers how much does he think of the dream that he had originally.
Hey, that's a great segue. So, perfect. We're just about out of time, but we did start a few minutes late. So, what is he thinking about the dreams back home? And I don't know that he is really thinking about those specifically until the brothers show up. And then it kind of all comes flooding back. But he is thinking about back home. Verse 50, before the year of the famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship in all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. I won't belabor this point, both for the sake of time and also because I kind of brought it up last time in terms of something to think about, but his children, as he names them, they're celebrating the end of his old life and the beginning of a new life. And so the question that I think is significant to ask is, what exactly is Joseph thinking about all of that? So Manasseh prays from delivering him from sorrow, specifically forgetting his father's house, not his brother's evil, his father's house. He does not use this as an opportunity to go back home and visit his dearly beloved dad. And, I mean, he's just been put on a chariot and toured over all of Egypt. He's in charge of everything. This 6 years into the time of plenty now, things are pretty well set up. I would imagine that he could spend a couple weeks if he wanted to. Instead, he names his firstborn son a name of celebration of forgetting his father's house. Again, I get the impression that he laid in bed awake in Potiphar's house for a very long time expecting his wealthy, powerful father to come save him, and he never did. Because he didn't know that his brothers had lied. He didn't know that his father thought he was dead. And so it's not until he realizes that through what he hears overhears Reuben saying in the prison that his attitude then kind of begins to change. Ephraim then prays for making him fruitful in his current life. A lot of the language here is similar to the language back in the 7 years of plentiful abundance and all of that. That is the life of Joseph now here in Egypt. So again, we won't belabor this, but it's worth thinking about. Also, the like the sand of the sea terminology showing up back in the earlier verses, not with the you've got the linguistic connection back to verses 47 through 49, where like the sand of the sea shows up. So there may be a way of thinking about that going back to the Abrahamic promises as well. But I think it's worth thinking about Joseph's perspective on his family. As we get to the point where Joseph's about to meet his family, what does he think about them? There are some people that read Joseph's actions with his brothers as he is trying to redeem them from the moment he sees them because he's just such a good, good person. And there are some people that read it as Joseph is bitter and angry and he's trying to torture them, and the only one he even cares about is Benjamin. And there's a whole lot of ground in between those two extremes. But at least be aware that there are different ways of reading Joseph's actions and attitudes toward his family as we get to this section of the story. Finally, then, there was famine in all the lands, we're told here, which is a surprising thing because very rarely is there simultaneous famine in Palestine and Egypt. They're not watered by the same sources. A lot of famines in Palestine. But Egypt is watered by the Nile, and the Nile is one of those things that it doesn't fail. You're going to have the water, but not this time. Not when it's a divinely prescribed famine. Even the Nile is not going to be a source. And I don't know if this means that it dried up or if it means the water was polluted in some way that was unusable. I don't know the answers to that, but whatever the case is, there is a divinely prescribed famine. And what this means is all the earth came to Joseph to buy grain. And this is what's setting up the next story. And so this chapter ends by pushing us forward to the next one. Greg, were you going to say something a while ago?
Yeah, actually,
okay. All right, well, we're definitely out of time now. So Sunday, I believe, I'm still going to be teaching. I don't think we're just switching this time. So I presume we'll be in chapter 42 on Sunday. And then, of course, next Wednesday night, Tom will be back doing Romans then.